Accession number 16808, Reel 28.
Reg Spittle's Reel 28.
So that was my introduction to the barracks in Bruges, and having sort of been there a day or two, you gradually have to be, everybody has to be booked in, and your recording and your history and all that sort of thing. And one thing you've all got is your personal weapons. In my case was an American Smith & Wesson P-38, you see, which they issued all tank crews with. And so that was handed into the armourer, and with the ammunition, which we carried about 20 rounds in a pouch. What I didn't hand in was the Luger. I'd already got a Luger from Normandy, because it seemed in Normandy that these Germans, especially among the tank crews and that, seemed to be quite reasonably common, Lugers, and that was something everybody was after, you see. And so I'd got one, which I kept, so I didn't tell them about that. And there was only one snag going to be from now on, because they either had 7 or 9 bullets in a clip which went up in the butt. And in Normandy, of course, you could always get plenty of ammunition from captured Germans or dead Germans or whatever. But from now on, of course, I wasn't going to be able to replace any ammunition if I fired it at all, you see. Not that I was expecting to fire it at all, because now I was going to be working in lines of communication. Now I was downgraded to C1. I was going to be a non-combatant. But it would be nice to have a personal weapon, which I was going to keep, you see, especially as a keepsake. Anyway, I handed my revolver in, and the longer you're there, the more you get into the routine of things, the more you learn about the system and the people there, you see. And I knew that when I left there, they were going to issue me with a rifle and a bandolier of 50 rounds of ammunition, which was the routine way that everybody left there. It didn't matter who they were. I was expected to take a rifle and 50 rounds of ammunition in a like a cloth bandolier which you slung on your shoulder. And I thought, no way am I going to be lumbered up with a rifle. So I used to make a point each week of going down to the armoury and requesting to withdraw my pistol and clean it and hand it back in again, you see. And the sergeant there, or quartermaster, whatever he was, he said, I don't know why you come in to do that, you know, Court. I said, well, it's my personal weapon. I said, and when I leave, I should be taking it with me. No, he said, you're wrong there, he said. The only people who take revolvers from here, he said, is officers, because there were officers there as well as other ranks, you see. He said, and it was soon obvious that it was a perk amongst the organisation that an officer, whatever he came with, and if he came from the infantry, it could quite well, he'd bring nothing at all or a rifle. I mean, although you will see officers with a pistol, they didn't seem to have them when they came to these sort of places. But they made sure that when they left, everybody had to have a weapon, you see, because you became useless in an emergency if you hadn't got any weapons to defend or put yourself at the disposal of the local person who was in charge of a defence force if they were necessary to have one. I mean, that was the reason, and when I came on leaves in England, we always brought our revolvers home on leave, and strangely enough, you never heard of anybody losing one. But the idea was that when you came on leave, if an emergency arose, say parachute drop of some sort in England, you were supposed to put yourself at the disposal of the local commander, whoever it was, of the local forces. And if you did that and you went empty-handed and they got nothing to give you, well, then you were just a pair of hands and you couldn't do much about the defence. So it was a normal thing during the war for everybody to take the personal weapon home and to be able to put themselves usefully at the disposal for defence purposes if necessary. So, of course, I dropped my revolver, which I had. So I used to do this, you see, and thinking, well, the problem of the argument I'm going to have, get to try and get my revolver back when I left instead of a rifle, I'll leave that to when the time comes, you see. And each day we used to parade on the ground, a normal morning parade, and they used to dish out fatigues from different, because we paraded in rooms, so it would be like my room of a couple of dozen chaps, of which I would be in charge, you see, and you stood out in front to report that the situation, because, I mean, in the morning, You perhaps have somebody say, oh, I'm going to go sick, he wasn't well or something, you see. And so you'd have to make arrangements for him to go to the MO at whatever time. And that would sort of say, the MO would have a thing, say at 10 o'clock every morning. So you had to make arrangements for him to go. So then you had to report in turn to the sergeant major who was taking the parade prior to the officer coming, you see, the state of your section. Whether you were all present or you got 22 men, one sick, and yourself would be, say, so you was not the 24th man. And so you used to parade in your room sections and report the strength of your room, you see, wherever they were. Then the sergeant major would come along and they'd detail so many men from each room for fatigues or whatever duties within the barracks, you see. Well, having got that over, because that was after breakfast time, so you have your breakfast and everything, and then you have the parade, first morning parade. And then, basically, for the rest of the day, you was at your own disposal. They couldn't sort of, you wasn't a regular regiment, you was a mixture of everything and everybody, all in various capacities of grades, from B1 down to whatever. I mean, I was C1, so I was quite low. And not expected to be able to do much, although physically I was perfectly all right. And so you had a lot of spare time on your hands, you see, but then you wasn't allowed to wander out into the town at your own time. You always had to have a control of you. So when you went out, you had the normal thing of booking out in the guard room and then booking in when you came back. So you spent a lot of slack time just filling your time in writing letters or polishing your boots up or whatever you did, you know, looking after your equipment, but such as what you got. You didn't have a lot by then, you see, because it had all been handed in. Anyway, the time drifted on, and there was always this resentment in these places, you know, people, really, I suppose, because they had a lot of spare time on their hands, a lot of spare time to look at how things were wrong. When you're in a unit, when there's things wrong or not going how you want it, there was always something else to occupy your mind that you didn't have time to worry about it. But now you were in a situation where you've got all day to worry about it. So if you felt you got a grievance of any sort, you sat there and it festered like a sore, you know, you could have an aggravation and you could dwell on it, you know, until it became an obsession with you. And the one obsession there at this time, because now we were into early 1945, and the units had started leave going, you see, throughout the forces. And naturally, the chaps were saying, bloody good, isn't it? Some had got brothers, you see, in the other forces, getting letters from home, and they say that Charlie's been home on leave, you know, and all this, that, and the other. And so the agitation came about getting leave. And of course, the thing was, this was a problem all the way through. To get leave, you had to belong to someone properly. Now, being in a holding unit, although you were there and they knew where you were, like the higher authorities knew exactly where you were, you didn't belong, because it was about, as I say, 4,000 odd blokes who were all waiting to be posted on to somewhere else. So you weren't a family, as you might say, you weren't a regiment, you were just a group of 4,000 individuals. And you were an individual in that group. So they couldn't give you any leave because they couldn't cater for you, you see. So, I mean, they might have sent that. The major there might have sent you on leave. He couldn't do, but I say, had he done so, he may have had a message come through that he wanted so many men posting to somewhere in a certain capacity. You could be one of those people. And that's what we were doing. We were all sitting there waiting to be collected, in effect, you see. Someone at somewhere in the organisation, whatever it was, in 21st Army Group, although you didn't realise it, somebody knew exactly where you were at all times in the forces, you see. And now, in my case, I was waiting for someone to say, well, what can we find him to do? Until they did, I was nobody doing nothing except loaf about until they found me a useful occupation. So if they sent you on leave and then a message comes through for you to be posted somewhere, the major would think, well, that's bloody handy. I'm just sent him off on 7 days leave. And now they want him sending up to Germany or somewhere, you see. So, of course, there was no chance of getting any leave, and it was agitating all the time. And I have a piece of poetry which is very naughty. I'll show it to you sometime. And it was posted up on the board, because you had the normal routine of board, first order, second orders, every day and every night. And someone, and there's always someone in the forces who's a bit of a wit in some direction or other. They can all tell a good story, they can tell jokes, you can get people sit there and they can roll jokes off for hours. And then you get people who can write poetry and just do poetry about anything. And of course we got one. And he wrote this poetry about the unit that was holding us, you see. And this was a 54 holding unit where we were. And it was mainly staffed by Remy, an ordnance corps. Now, whether they were downgraded men or not, I don't know. But the bulk of the staff were from those two formations, from the Remy and the Ordnance Corps. And so if there's any complaints or agitation or aggravation, they get the blame, you see, because they're in charge of the barracks. And this chap wrote this piece of poetry, and it headed Leave. And he goes on about, very disrespectfully, about the Remy and the Ordnance Corps, and as he puts it in words, not knowing the truth of what he's writing, because they could have been downgraded, men, as I say, and for the same reason that I was being downgraded, from being in action and being disabled. And they were probably all the same. They were probably not A1 men, you see. And not knowing this, I mean, but he's got a grievance. So you don't look at the truth of the situation. You do your grievance, and it's not necessarily always correct. But anyway, he wrote this poetry, and it really slams into the staff of the Remy and the Ordnance Corps people and the Major, Tash. He got a lovely moustache, so they called him Tash. And again, I'll never ever remember his name. And this piece of poetry is really amusing, but not very complimentary to the staff of 54 RHU at Bruges. But nevertheless, it added a bit of spice to life and caused a bit of humour in a situation. And so anyway, the times keeps going on, and things are happening. And I'd mucked in with old Sid, and he was a more of a fatherly figure to me. He was a sort of a bit chubby, he was, old Sid, and he was a chap who'd get on with anybody, obviously. And he was, if ever you see Dad's Army and you saw the old boy who was the medical chap in Dad's Army on the television, who never had a weapon, and he was all bumbling about, and he was all, and like Sid, he had prostate trouble, always going to want to go to the loo. Sid was a dead ringer for that character. And somehow or other we sort of mucked in together and we became friends. And after we'd settled in, the weeks went by, and it began to look as though he was going to be there for duration. And I mean, some people came in and was out the next day. Others, like myself, seemed as though they were going to be stuck there for, well, ever after. And weeks was going by, and I suddenly said to Sid, "Hey, I said, I've got this letter," I said, "from old Andre at Zillingham," I said, "about his master," I said, "how about we go round?" He said, "Yeah, I suppose we could, couldn't we? See what's what, you know." So anyway, we goes round, we finds this street where it was, and finds Gaston van der Kerkhoven, and he got his little plate on the wall because he was the principal shoemaker for the district. And it was in quite a nice area, suburb of the town, because what you find in places is there's always an area where the pubs of ill repute are, and the brothels are, and the places that you ought not to be after dark unless you've got a confederate with you. And Bruges was no exception. However small it is, it still had a district of nightlife. And so Gaston was his area. He lived in a sort of a nice suburban area, say, quite middle class type of thing, you see, because he was comfortably off compared to the rest. And we goes round, you see, finds this house, has a little bit of a debate whether we ought to knock the door or not. Having plucked up courage, we knocks the door, and suddenly here's these clugs, you see, because whether it's the way they live in that sort of middle class life, but they never carpeted the ground floor. It was always tiled. And they always wore clogs. They only wore the shoes when they went out. And so we heard these clunk, 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 clunk up the passage. And then the door opened a little bit. And that was my first experience of a chain on the door. They were more advanced, you see, and they had a chain on the door. And the door opened about 6 inches, and a face peered out, and it was a lady. She took one look, bang went the door, bump went the bolt, and clunk, 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 back up the passage. I said to Sarah, I said, that's buggered it. I said, they don't like it. So anyway, after a point where we almost got to the point of going away, and clunk, 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 up the passage came the clogs, and the chain came off, and the door, the bolt went back, and the door opened, and Gaston himself stood there, you see. He said, good evening, or good afternoon, or whatever it was, you see. And he spoke good English, Gaston did. Now, Suzanne, his wife, spoke very poor English, but she was could always understand what you were saying. And she was a lovely person, and they got one son, who at that time was only a baby, really, you know, Peter. And he said, good evening, Lord. I said, oh, good evening. I said, sorry to intrude, I said, but we've been stationed at Zillingen, I said, and explained the situation about Andre. I said, and he's given me a letter of introduction to you and suggested we visit you. So I gave him the letter and he read it, and I could tell by his attitude, poor old Andre was going to get a bright old wee when he saw him next time. He wasn't at all pleased that he'd given us this letter of introduction. Anyway, he said, best to come in. I said, that's all right, is it? He said, yes, you must come in. So we went in, you see, went down the passage and into the middle room in the house, and it was remarkable there. They got a massive big stove in the centre of the room, and it was all tiled all round. A beautiful thing it was. And instead of having a fireplace in like one wall or another with a chimney out, it was sensible. They had this, and it seemed to be quite common in Belgium. They had this massive stove in the centre of the room, and the chimney went up, not to the ceiling quite. The ceilings were very high, and then the chimney went to the wall, to an outlet outside, you see. And they used to hang, because of the stove, the pipe was quite warm but not hot, so they used to hang towels and things all over it to air clothing or dry clothing. And of course they didn't lose any heat from the, not like we do, I mean half of our heat goes up the chimney, but theirs didn't because it was in the middle of the room, so the room was beautifully warm in that. And it was a large room, so it didn't sort of interfere, and the pipe was high enough that you walked under it, so that didn't interfere. And of course, the inevitable thing, they got the coffee pot on. They've always got a coffee pot, you see, with this black coffee. And they used to have these little cups, not much bigger than egg cups, they seemed to me. And he said, you will have coffee. So I said, thank you. So he didn't ask or offer, but it was black. Just black coffee, you see. And it was quite bitter. It wasn't to my liking, actually, but I thought, well, I don't know, I don't want to put my foot in it, you see. I don't want to upset anybody. So I thought, well, I can't, if I'd have been at home, I'd have put milk and sugar in, you see. But I thought, well, perhaps they haven't got any milk and sugar. So I looked at Sid. Sid looked at me, and we painfully drank this cup of coffee. Fortunately, as I say, it wasn't much bigger than an egg cup anyway. And that was my introduction, and Sid, to Gaston and Suzanne. And Peter was a baby, you see. I suppose he'd be about 18 months, just running about sort of thing. Well, we spent basically an uncomfortable hour or so, because obviously we were intruders into their way of life. And Gaston was obviously very suspicious of strangers, which he'd learned after 4 years of occupation with the Germans. I suppose that's the way they'd learned to live, you see. So at an appropriate time, I said, well, perhaps we should leave and go back. So Gaston said, yes, if you must, you know. And so when we was going, well, I said, would it be possible we could come again? He said, yes, you're welcome. And we were sort of stuttering away at each other in their sort of pidgin English, pidgin Belgian, and that, you see, because they don't speak French there, they speak Flemish, you see, Bruges, which is different. They're like the Basques in Spain, you see. They're rebels, really. I mean, they never started a revolution, but I think they would if they thought they could get their own rule. But anyway, so they speak Flemish, you see. And after a time, it became quite easy to read it. It was a language you easily picked up, really. And but anyway, so we said, would we come again? He said, yes, you will be welcome. He didn't say, of course you can, like we would in England. He said, you will be welcome. Very stiff, you see. So Sid and I had a debate then whether we ought to go, you know, saying, well, I don't know, Sid, I mean, it wasn't very comfortable, was it, you know? And I mean, we weren't really welcome, was we, like, you know? And well, it was the first time, you know, and I mean, they are being occupied, and you know, and after all, it was the Canadians who liberated them, not the British, you see. And they were very proud of that in the Bruges, about the Belgians that liberated Bruges, the Canadians liberated Bruges, it wasn't the British, you see. Anyway, I don't know whether we went back the same week or a week later, but we eventually went back again, you see. And I said, well, we better take some cigarettes and stuff, you see, show we're friendly. And of course, as you know, I was getting their regular rations with their room, so, and I don't smoke, never have smoked, you see, so my cigarettes were there for bartering purposes with anything or anybody or whatever, you see. And I mean, if you had, in my case, we were getting about 50 cigarettes a week, the ration, and with that, you could have almost had a brothel on your own if you'd wanted, if way inclined, with 50 cigarettes a week. So, anyway. Cigarettes were a really barterable thing, you see, and so not they used to be in tins of 50, but they also used to have packets of 10. So I used to swap my 50 for the packets of 10, you see, because some people seem to want 50s. I don't know why, whether they sent them home or whatever, where they got the feet under the table and it got them a bit more privilege with a 50 than a packet of 10. And I used to go around, so then I said, well, take them some cigarettes, you see. So the next time we went, I took them cigarettes, and he said, oh, thank you, and all that. And we were more welcome, obviously, you see. Well, then time drifted on, and we did become friends. And after the war, we were great friends with Gaston and Suzanne and the family. And I was able to help him in lots of ways with his work, you see, because after the war, it was strange. All his sewing machines were German. And of course, after the war, he couldn't, all his contacts that he had in Germany for replacement parts and needles and threads had been bombed out, you see. The factories had gone until they could get reorganized again. And it was common because I could buy this stuff in Northampton, because Northampton was a boot and shoe town, you see, at that time, very much so. It was basically the only industry in the town still after the war for many years. And I used to get the threads and the needles and the stuff, and even spare parts from the local places, the mercers and the shoe mercers in Northampton. And I used to pass them up and send them to Bruges, to Gaston, you see. And we had this friendship developed, you see. And we went there in 1947 for a fortnight's holiday. The wife and our daughter, who was at that time about 18 months old, and the wife's brother. And we had a fortnight with Gaston and Suzanne, which was all free because they were repaying a friendship. But anyway, I used to take his cigarettes around to him, you see. And he told me after the war, he always made out he was pleased, you see. And while we were there, he would always open the packet because they were in cellophane, the packets were, and they always had a cigarette card in them. And he would open the packet while we were there, during that period we were there having coffee and talking. And he would smoke one cigarette, you see. And it wasn't until after the war, and it just shows you that for all the friendship we were developing, for the months that I was stationed in Bruges, it was always this suspicion of how he stood regarding our friendship, because he didn't smoke. But he would always During the evening we were there, he would always unpack the cigarette packet and take one out and smoke it. So I saw him smoke a cigarette. And he told me after the war, when we were talking and that, he always did that to impress on me that the cigarettes were used, you see. But he always used them for black market, for bartering. And he told me, he said he was ashamed, in our friendship developed, he told me, he said, I was now ashamed, Reg, that I did not trust you then, as I should have realised I could trust you. He said, because if I could have had that cigarette packet unsealed, still sealed up like, it would have been worth far more bartering than it would be loose cigarettes. But it just shows you how the distrust had grown into people over 4 years of occupation under the Germans. That it was going to take time for them to readjust to trust, even among friends. And he told me this, you see. And anyway, we used to have chocolate and stuff like that, you see. And I used to, of course I got rain, so I used to take him cigarettes, and I suppose the quantity increased as we got more friendly, and I used to take him a bar of chocolate rain every week. And this bar of chocolate used to be in eight segments. And he told me what they did, you see. And each day, one portion they give to the boy, you see. So at the end of the week, they had one portion left. And Suzanne had that. And that's how they used to dispose. We can switch that off, isn't it? So that was how I used to dispose of the bar of chocolate, you see. So anyway, time went on, and we had some funny times, because a thing that used to happen, apparently, the Germans used to ask people to go to Germany to work in the factories and that, you see, before they got to the point where they'd take people off the streets and that sort of thing that we hear about. And if they were volunteered, their family would get extra rations and be taken care of, you might say, you see, while they're away. And they would go for a stipulated period of time, say 3 months or 6 months, in the work that they were able to do, and then they would come back, you see. And they didn't go out for years, they just went for a period of time. Gaston was telling me about this. And because he was the shoemaker, he had a lot to do with the Germans, you see, because the boots used to come there. And this is why Suzanne was terrified, because she only had to see a German, and she was sort of down the cellar quick, out of the way. And he was telling us these funny pieces about how they lived under the Germans and that. And I used to meet his friends. We were there. They would come, and we began to build a friendship with his friends, you see. As time went on, it became this little bit more of a trust in it. And this little chap used to come in, comical little chap, and if I could understand the language, I'd have understood the jokes better, because he was always full of fun and laughs and all that, you see, telling witty stories, which I didn't catch on to. And I must have said to Gaston what a comical chap he was, you see. And Gaston said, yes, he said, he was an unlucky man. He said, because he has a big family. He got about six or seven children, you see, and he's only a little chap. And the usual thing, his wife was a big woman. And when it came to volunteering these chaps to go to work in Germany for the extra profit they got from it in rations and stuff, they wouldn't take him. And I said to Gaston, I said, boy, why not? I said, if he's willing. No, he said, the Germans said they couldn't afford to keep his family while he was away, because he got about six or seven children. It had been too expensive for the Germans to give the rations, you see. So he was stuck, he couldn't go to Germany to work. But just one of the funny little stories, like, you know. And we used to go, as I say, to Gaston, and we became very friendly and all that sort of thing. And time wore on, and of course, in the barracks, as I say, things were miserable, really, and it was a sort of a dreary sort of an existence. The longer you were there, the more indoctrinated to it you got. And Bruges was only a small place, so there was nowhere to go. I mean, if he was in a place like Brussels, where I went to eventually, I mean, there was plenty of scope for pleasure and leisure and all that, you see, but there was nothing in Bruges. And, you know, civilization hadn't reached it, like from the army's point of view. And we had these troubles come up, and this one chap in our room, he used to have black and white photographs. And I don't know what his proper job was, but he got his kit that he kept. And he used to try and change your black and white photos into coloured ones by hand, you see. And